Well, as I said earlier, we start a three-week series tonight leading into the Easter weekend entitled Understanding Easter. And the primary purpose of it is to understand Easter. But it's also to really get us to focus on the Easter event and to think afresh about it. This evening we start with the topic of God's wrath and how we might think about that in light of the cross. The problem, of course, with talking about God's wrath is it's slightly problematic, culturally, socially awkward. I don't know if you ever had a conversation with a perfect stranger about God's wrath. It usually doesn't happen. And if you're a high school student, for example, or a university student, perhaps the greatest criticism of God, the God characterized in the Bible, is that he is an angry God. He's angry at people. I mean, you pick the thing, he's angry at it. That's how a lot of people think about God. There's a whole movement called New Atheism. It's not that new anymore. It's been around for a while. But there's a guy called Richard Dawkins. You may or may not have heard of him. He's one of the poster guys for this, if you can be a poster guy for New Atheism. And Dawkins writes a number of books. Here's a quote from one of his books talking about God as angry or wrathful. This is what he writes. God's monumental rage, whenever his chosen people flirted with a rival god, resembles nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind. Now, I actually think Dawkins is an excellent writer. He's poetic, he's descriptive, he's easy to read. But when you read him, and I was flicking through his book only to get drawn into sections of his book, it's very clear that he has a very flat understanding of God and God's character. God is simple. He's simply bad. Actually, he's simply non-existent. But non-existent for the reason that he's bad, if that makes any sense. The thing I want to challenge us with tonight is that God is actually far more complex than that. We, in fact, can be Christians and hold to very simplistic views of God's character. We can use lines like God is love, and with three words feel like we've summarized the full character of God. And yet the scriptures constantly challenge us that the God who is revealed to us is more complex than that, and this is true even with the idea of God's wrath. We meet, in a sense, some of God's complexity and character in the events Mike just read to us from Matthew chapter 26, the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, you've probably read these. If you've been to church for a few years, you've at least read them, I reckon, 5-6 times, because every time we come to Easter, we end up reading this account in one of the Gospels. But if you've been a believer for a while, you've read this dozens upon dozens of times. And so you might not come to this very fresh, but imagine you're reading for the first time. I suspect the first time you come to read the Garden of Gethsemane account, you are struck, actually, with what Jesus is doing. If you were a disciple there, an apostle there, in that garden at that moment when the things that are accounted take place, you would be struck by the fact that Jesus has suddenly found himself broken on his knees. And he's uttering words like, "I am very sorrowful, even unto death." And the question, of course, that's raised for us as we encounter this perhaps afresh or perhaps for the first time is, why does he grieve like this? What breaks him so much? Well, in Matthew's account of the garden, the repeating theme is this idea of the cup of wrath, cup of wrath. And what does he mean by that? I mean, Jesus is not just a poet. He is quoting the cup of wrath for a very specific reason. The Jeremiah passage is our hint for it. You see, the cup of wrath is an image that recurs in the Old Testament over and over. Here are some references for those who take note. You might want to go back and read these later. Habakkuk 2:16, Lamentations 4:21, Ezekiel 23, verses 32 to 34, Isaiah 51:17. All of these have references to the cup of wrath, and particularly using the image of the cup of wrath as an image of God's judgment on all that is evil. Judgment on the sinners, on those who've turned their back on him. So what does the Old Testament tell us about this cup of wrath? Well, we'll think a little bit about it in the context of the Jeremiah passage, but perhaps slightly broader as well. Firstly, it is important to realize that in all the accounts and all the times that the cup of wrath comes up, God's wrath comes because people fail to listen. People fail to listen to him particularly. In the 14 verses before our reading, we read verse 15 to 29, in verses 1 to 14, there's an account, and in that account, over and over, the reoccurring phrase is, you did not listen to me. You did not listen to me. You did not listen to me. And this is the theme that continues, and this is the theme of the Old Testament. God's wrath comes to all those people who do not listen to him, who do not give him the respect that's due God, who move him out of the center. And of course, this is the story not just of the people in Jeremiah's time, it's the story of the whole of Israel, of all the nations, that they have constantly moved God out of the center position. They have sought to become most important. They have sought to live their own way. And this is where Dawkins gets things wrong to start with. God is not, he's not like a jealous lover. God is a rightly wronged God. He's meant to be at the center. That's the essence of being God. And so when he responds to people who have repeatedly, over and over and over again, turned their back on him. Secondly, God's wrath is universally applicable. What do I mean by this? I mean that no one escapes God's wrath in the end. It's interesting, isn't it? There's a whole list of nations read out to us in Jeremiah. Nation upon nation. The start of Jerusalem, it goes out further and further, it goes across the sea. Princes and kings, it doesn't matter what status you are. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or you're poor. It doesn't matter whether you're powerful or you are weak. Everyone is encountered. And at the end of the list is Shishak or Babylon. That's how, if you're in Hebrew and you're reading that, you'd say, oh, Babylon. Babylon? Babylon receives God's wrath? Interestingly, at this point, the Hebrews are in exile. So that's actually a word of comfort for them, which makes God's wrath take to a whole other level of complexity, doesn't it, at that point? That it's actually comforting that God might issue his wrath to Babylon. But the main point of that list is that no one will escape the reach of God's cup of wrath. Everyone comes underneath it because everyone has turned their back on him. But overwhelmingly, the thing that the Old Testament really drives home for us is that God's wrath is fierce and unrelenting. Jeremiah 25, verse 27, drink and be drunk and vomit to fall and rise no more. It's the vivid metaphor of the downfall of nation upon nation. But you want to see the violence of God's wrath? Take these verses from Isaiah 63, verse 3. I have trodden, this is the Lord speaking, he says, I have trodden the winepress alone. From the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them down in my wrath. Their blood spattered my garments and I stained all my clothing. There is such violence, such overwhelming violence in that description of God's wrath. Destructive and violent. But the wrath of God described in the Old Testament is not just an Old Testament concept. Paul in Romans chapter 1 verse 18 says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people. But of course, I think perhaps the best example of wrath being prevalent, being center stage, God's wrath and God's anger, is the Garden of Gethsemane. Because at that point, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is reduced to fear and anguish as he is confronted with God's wrath, as he looks into the cup. And so as you turn the pages from Malachi to Matthew, you don't move on from God's wrath. You see God acting consistently between the two testaments. I want us to consider that moment in the garden, but it's often hard to consider something we've read over and over. So hear these words of one writer who recasts the Gethsemane moment after having kind of reflected on the different gospel accounts, this is how he kind of thinks about it and describes it. It's obviously not scriptural, but it might help us to reflect on what's happening. He writes these words. 11 remained then, but soon there would be none. Not one friend would stay. Strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. One would run terrified out of the garden naked and the rest would follow. Jesus fell on his face in prayer. He tasted the dirt as he fought for the eternal destinies of his 11 sleeping sheep a stone's throw away. Let the cup pass, he cried. Father, if it's possible, let the cup pass. The father gazed lovingly at his son, and the son stared back knowingly. Your will be done, Father, whispered the son. And the father held out the cup, and Jesus looked in. What he saw there flung him into the throes of agony. He pressed his forehead deep into the dirt, which softened into mud when mingled with his tears. Jesus felt several small explosions of pain under the skin of his face. His tiny capillaries in the sweat glands burst under the stress, and blood flowed through his pores and dropped into his eyes, and it stung. See, what's compelling, what's complex about the Garden of Gethsemane is that this is Jesus, the King of Kings. He's the one who didn't flinch in the face of the Pharisees, who showed no fear in the face of rulers and authorities, the one who could at any time, he says, call down a legion of angels, who spent 40 days in the wilderness without food or drink, and yet who is driven to the very edge at this moment as he comes face to face with God's wrath. What horror it must have been to comprehend that. It's because he knows that every word uttered by the Lord of anger and judgment against his people has now become his destiny. He realizes that he's the one who's going to be trampled down in anger. He's the one who's going to be trod in wrath. He's the one whose blood is going to be spattered on garments and who's going to be stained. He is the one who'll be the subject of God's wrath. Now, while we get God's wrath clear, and while it's repeated throughout the scriptures, we do a particularly good job of avoiding it. I'm going to read to you a quote from a guy called Jonathan Edwards. He's a preacher in the 1700s, long time ago, right? I want to imagine, though, you're in a congregation quite different to this one. Okay, you're young adults, you're hardened against the world. But imagine a congregation that's of greater spread. There's young children in this congregation. They're innocent and sweet and lovely, right? There's old people, there's young people. Edwards writes these words. He preached this great sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's a fearsome sermon. He writes these words about halfway through the sermon. And you, children who are unconverted, do you not know that you are going down to hell to bear the dreadful wrath of that God who is not angry with you every day and every night? Now, I might have said it slightly differently, but might be a different time and place, and we give him all that. But do we ever speak of wrath like that? Do we speak to our Sunday school kids about the judgment of God? Do we speak to our peers? Do we speak to our family members about the reality of God's wrath and anger and judgment? Now, most of us approach this topic with trepidation. And I think that there's something right about that, at least in part, because to speak about God's wrath, as we've been reflecting on, is to speak about something intense and something overwhelming. But I suspect we have fears about speaking about it incorrectly. But I think we also just have fears of people, as we were thinking about last week when we speak about this. If you'd permit me, two reasons why I think sometimes we get the idea of God's wrath wrong, and therefore we feel like we cannot speak about it. Firstly, we incorrectly characterize God and his wrath. We think in human terms about God's wrath and anger. We think it's variable and uncertain and at times perhaps unjust. I don't know if you've been in a supermarket at that time when you see a parent frantically running through the aisles looking for their child, only to find them, you know, kind of about to push over a big stack of cans, and they grab them and they say, "Where were you? You are never to leave me behind." And they wrench them by the arm and off goes the child screaming. Perhaps you've been that child. In the morning I said, perhaps you've been that parent. How we change over the day. But, you know, we look at that and we say, we look at it with a slight sense of awkwardness and horror and yet empathy and understanding, and we sense the parent is anxious for their child, desperately anxious perhaps at moments, has someone taken them? And there's a sense of relief, but there's also a sense of uncontrolled anger at that and frustration and blame being cast at their child at that very moment. And we think God works like that parent. We think that sometimes he just loses it. Sometimes he just crushes someone. There's a great Far Side comic. I forgot to get the overhead for it, but it's by Gary Larson. It's got this old man sitting at a computer, and on the screen is just this guy walking along the street, and there's a piano about to fall on his head, and God is about to press the button on the computer that says smite. And we think that's how God works. He's vindictive. Perhaps he even engages in wrath because it's funny and because he's powerful. But that is not how God engages in wrath at all. That's how humans engage in wrath. That's how we engage in anger. But that's not how God does. Think about the image that's used to describe wrath in Jeremiah. A cup, small, contained, given to all the right people who God has specified at the right time. That's how God's wrath comes. But the second mistake is we overestimate ourselves. This is a trait the disciples made often. A couple of hours before Garden of Gethsemane, they're at dinner. Peter says, "I'll never leave you, Jesus." A couple of hours after Garden of Gethsemane, Peter denies Jesus three times. Of course, even in the garden, you know, Peter must have thought, "Oh, I've got selected. I'm in the in group. I'm in the circle. I'm one of three other people with Jesus this great moment." And he falls asleep. Three times he falls asleep. We have these weaknesses, but we think we can somehow weasel our way out of them or work around them or justify ourselves. I was a boarder when I was at school, and when I was at school, the cane was still in. I don't think it's in anymore, particularly in light of the Royal Commission. But it was back then. And I remember one evening, one of the guys got sent to the housemaster's office to get the cane. He'd done something fairly significant. And so before he went to the housemaster's office, he prepared accordingly by taking a number of newspapers and shoving it down his pants. And then he went into the housemaster's office and bent over, ready to receive the cane. And, of course, the housemaster saw that what he'd clearly done. He was amused. In fact, he thought this was quite ingenious, so he let him off. I told this story in the morning, actually, and people were outraged that he got let off. That says something about our need for justice. We're a bit more low-key down in the evening, aren't we? Good on him, do you say? You know what? We think we can justify ourselves. We can weasel our way out of God's judgment. We can find the back door. We can find the loophole or the special clause. We can write in the special clause, perhaps, so that we do not need to come under the wrath of God. Perhaps we play the comparison game. We don't even bother comparing ourselves to Hitler. We just look at the person next to us in the pew and say, "At least I was here on time." Or perhaps we readily just turn our good works into a way of becoming forgetful about our failings. Have you ever said these words? "God, at least I'm trying. I'm trying my best." And so we ignore wrath, we ignore judgment, we ignore the righteous anger of God against sin over and over. But hear these words of God to the nations in Jeremiah 25:28. "If they refuse to take the cup from your hand," says God to Jeremiah, "and drink, tell them, this is what the Lord Almighty says, you must drink it." You must drink it. In other words, you can't ignore this. You can't ignore this aspect of God's character. You can't create a flat picture of God that suits you and pretend that God's wrath is no longer applicable to you. You must drink it. Now, if I stopped here, I've painted a picture of God, a picture, in fact, that some of you here may agree with. Certainly, there'd be many people who believe in the concept of God, if they're not believers, who would agree with my description of God. They believe that God is vindictive, that he's powerful, that he's autocratic, and he's merciless. And they have good reason to believe this, because most of our encounters with authority in our culture are vindictive and autocratic and merciless. Take the two Australians on death row in Indonesia at this point. For the president to pardon them is a moment of weakness, not power. To act as a president in that occasion is to exercise autocracy without mercy. And that's what we expect from God, lots of people. Lots of people expect that from God. And so my description of God in some ways would fit right into their view of him, and they would go along with life. They wouldn't disagree. What they'd actually do is they'd just say, that's not the God I want to be part of. And so they'll leave him behind. They'll distance themselves. Stephen King, actually, the writer, said this. He believes in God, and he says, God is cruel. It's not that he doesn't think God exists. He just thinks God is cruel. Yet when we come to the gospel, what it reveals to us is that God is far more complex than that flat picture. C.S. Lewis wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, right? He creates this character Aslan, the lion, who is the kind of the analogy of God in his story, the correlation point. And Susan is about to meet Aslan, finally. She says to Mr. Beaver, what's Aslan like? Is he safe? Mr. Beaver says, oh, no, he isn't safe, but he's good. He isn't safe, but he's good. God is complex. And the only way we can come to understand God in some of that, truly in some of that complexity, is when we gaze upon the cross of the Lord Jesus. See, Easter is actually indispensable for understanding the character of God. In Gethsemane, Jesus, the Son of God, chooses to drink the cup of wrath. He's, of course, referring to the impending death on the cross, where he will willingly substitute himself for anyone who would have him do so. On the cross, the Father and the Son at one in this project, Jesus says, not my will but yours, work to bear the righteous wrath of God, to what Paul calls propitiate the wrath of God, to bear God's anger. This is the complex nature of God. On the cross, we see a God who hates sin and the sinner and yet becomes sin for us, says Paul. On the cross, we see a God who is committed to punishing sin, but is also the God, well, who will bear the punishment for sin. And on the cross, we see a God who tramples down evil, yet willingly and purposefully and obediently will be the one who will stand under that great foot of wrath himself. And so if we lose the bad news, so to speak, the wrath of God, the anger of God, what we actually do is we strip the goodness out of the gospel. We strip the goodness out of the good news. What would the Garden of Gethsemane be if you took out the prayer and the cup and the desperation of Jesus in that moment? It would leave Jesus as a fool, wouldn't it? Who goes to the cross for no purpose. Rather, the cross reveals a God who says, the cup of wrath must be drunk, but I will drink it. But I will drink it. You don't get that conception of God. You don't get that delicate balance between his wrath, his anger, and his abiding, faithful love unless you constantly look to the cross. You can't invent that balance in your head. You can't protect that balance in your head. The only way you can know it and live it and be transformed by it is if you constantly see God in action on the cross. You can't feel it. In fact, you won't always feel it. But you will know it when you see Jesus acting for you on the cross, bearing your sin and my sin, so that we might be the children of the living God. Amen.